Today's episode is brought to you by Media for All, which was set up to help encourage more Black, Asian and other ethnic talent into media, and to provide a support and mentoring network to ensure talent flourishes in the media industry that we all love. If you're looking for a mentor or would like to mentor young ethnic talent, check them out at mediaforall.org.uk, and it is all 100% free.
Hello and welcome to the Shiny New Object Podcast. My name is Tom Ollerton. I'm the founder of Automated Creative, and this is a podcast about the future of marketing. Every week or so, I have the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing one of our industry's leaders, and this week is absolutely no different. I'm very excited to finally be on a call with Rory Sutherland, who is Vice Chairman at Ogilvy UK. Rory's a very recognisable figure in the industry, but for the audience who don't know who you are and what you do, can you give us an overview?
Yeah, as well as being the Vice Chairman of Ogilvy, following my stint as IPA President, I founded a behavioural science practice at Ogilvy, which is now part of Ogilvy Consulting, where we look at how the latest insights into psychology and human behaviour can inform business and public policy decisions, and obviously marketing, but not only marketing.
And can you give us a bit of background on your career up to this point?
I joined Ogilvy and Mather Direct, which was the one-to-one or direct marketing wing of Ogilvy in Knightway House, 20 Soho Square or 25 Soho Square. Joined in September 1988. I joined obviously as a graduate trainee and was expected to become an account man, but I was terrible at being an account man. So in a move which probably couldn't take place nowadays, I was briefly a planner and then joined the creative department as a copywriter in around about, I think it must have been sort of June 1990. And then I worked with a succession of very good art directors and was lucky enough to do that. Ended up as head of copy and then creative director of the direct part of the business. And of course was there for the entire duration of what you might call the first wave of internet enthusiasm. And of course, being in a direct marketing agency was the best place to be because it was mostly post and telephone back then with a little bit of fax marketing, because those were the only addressable bi-directional media. You at least had some familiarity with the whole concept of interactive media, if you like. And I'd been lucky because my brother was an astrophysicist and I was at the same university as him. So even dating back to sort of 1982, I used to blag computer time and internet time off him back in 86 would be more accurate, actually, in 86. And I started using internet news groups, Usenet, as it was called. And I was completely hooked and fascinated from that point on. So when the web came along, again, my brother then being an academic, I got to hear about the web ridiculously early and was part of a small group of people, including, say, Ajaz Ahmed, now at AKQA, who were on this tiny, tiny conference circuit going around little basement rooms in London, effectively saying to an audience of 47 people, you know, this is going to be quite important. And I was in a perfect place. I should have made a fortune, actually. That was where I goofed. But I was in this perfect place at the intersection of understanding the internet and knowing what it was and why it was transformative, and also understanding one-to-one marketing. So I couldn't have been luckier in that respect.
So in that very varied career, and I had no idea you were so plugged into the internet at such an early stage while I was still learning how to do ollie kickflips in Northumberland. But anyway, I'm curious to know, what is the most useful thing that you've ever bought with your own money that you use for work?
I gotta say recently, because actually oddly the most useful thing, but it's now several years old, is a Google Chromebook Pixel. I'm a huge devotee of the Chromebook for lots of reasons. It's a strange thing. It's one of those things that's very difficult to sell or explain to anyone else, but once you've used it, you become an instant convert. More recently, I bought a Sony ZV-1 vlogging camera, which I've pimped up with all manner of other things because that's how I roll, which has proved extraordinarily useful because my job, which was involved quite a bit of sort of speaking beforehand, has involved quite a lot of filmmaking under lockdown. And I have to say the ZV-1 is a fantastic camera. Really, really brilliant.
And how has your content changed? Obviously, you're recording it on a different device, but have you developed a new kind of presenting? Or are you more multimedia now? I think famously you used to present without notes, if I remember correctly, or certainly last time.
Yeah, I still try and do that, actually. I don't know why. That's not to say I don't plan what I'm saying. But I generally, what I do is I take about 3 amateurish runs at it and fluff it, by which time I should be able to get it right the 4th time round. And I would like, actually, if I had a little more time, I'd like to explore filmmaking quite a lot more. I'm a big fan of a thing called WeVideo, which is online video editing. And the great advantage is it all takes place on the cloud, so it doesn't matter how powerful or otherwise your laptop is. It doesn't occupy your laptop in sort of half an hour of processing. And so WeVideo.com, which again, I think I pay for and don't claim for, stupidly, I should really claim for it, shouldn't I? But WeVideo has proved very useful as well. So the ability to make films and the ability to give talks remotely in general has been pretty fabulous.
So you have an incredibly senior role and a very high expectation of your time on doing presentations, whether it was in the real world and now through the technologies you mentioned. So I'm really keen to know, what are the tools or tricks or mindsets that you employ to help you deal when it all gets a bit much?
I'm very bad at it. In fact, I'm working with a team of psychologists at the moment at Cambridge who are looking at, if you think about it, blue collar workers have been kind of tailorized and optimized within an inch of their lives, haven't they? You know, if you're, if you're an Uber driver or you're any kind of blue collar employee, you know, there's an enormous amount of time made short that, every minute of your time is spent maximize efficiency. And yet the amount of experimentation with white collar work is dismally low. And one of the important tricks I've discovered, there are quite a few of them. One of my suggestions is that diary software needs to build in weather forecasting so that the nature of your working day should sensibly shift a bit depending on whether it's sunny and pleasant in the middle of the day or whether it's raining. Because when we sign up to work, for an employer, we effectively sign away 5/7 of our daylight for most of the year. And it's too much. And so I'm very, very interested in experimenting with different modes of working. The one unfailing lesson, and by the way, I can recommend a very good paper on this. It's called Make a Schedule versus Manage a Schedule. It's written by Paul Graham of Y Combinator. And he makes the point that it isn't the amount of time you have, it's the amount of discretionary, uninterrupted time you have that makes a difference. And one of the things I've been bad at, and I'm only learning to do now, is to carve out sufficiently long blocks of time to do that kind of work which can't be split into segments or split into smaller pockets. And that's the essential trick. I've got a little flat, a bolt hole down in Deal on the coast. And for example, when it came to writing my book, I had to go down there. It was impossible to try and do that at home. And so that business of secluding yourself for a couple of days at a time and devoting yourself to one thing and one thing only is really, really important. And it's badly damaged by, well, apart from anything else, email and scheduling software, plus a load of other technologies, which tend to always prioritize the urgent over the important and the immediate over the longer term. And I think we actually direct our time very, very badly because we tend to think of units of the day as being fungible and they're not. And what Paul Graham, who's a Brit, I'm proud to say, what Paul Graham says in this piece, Make a Schedule versus Manage a Schedule, is that managers can effectively cram as much in as they like because their kind of work is simply a matter of kind of making decisions rapidly in quick succession. More complex problems require long, contiguous periods of uninterrupted time. And he always explains that when a manager bangs a half-hour meeting into the afternoon of, say, might be a coder, okay? To the manager, that's half an hour of their time. The opportunity cost is very low. To the coder, that's the whole afternoon gone. Because an afternoon with a half-hour meeting right in the middle of it is no longer four uninterrupted hours of concentrated work. And I think that's very, very important. There's also the fact that John Cleese writes about this in his latest book on creativity, which is that creative people postpone and essentially, play fast and loose with deadlines for a very good reason, which is if you're doing a creative job as opposed to a kind of deterministic or process-driven job, okay, the reason you leave everything to the last minute is you're maximizing the chance of getting lucky. Because you know that the later you leave it, the more odds there are of some idea or insight surfacing in your brain. There's also a greater chance that you'll accidentally discover something which you suddenly realize is germane to the problem. So the reason they did an experiment with architects where they took architects widely believed to be the most creative and the least creative, and they looked for commonalities between the most creative architects and those things which most distinguished them from the least creative architects. They obviously didn't tell the least creative architects, you've been nominated as a spectacularly unimaginative architect, so would you like to participate in our research? They gave them some bullshit story about why they'd been chosen. But the least creative architects tended to do things to a schedule, where the most creative architects understood that actually in playing chicken with a deadline, you are maximizing the chance of something remarkable happening.
Which is just absolutely terrifying to any new business person trying to
organize
a
pitch. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
I know that feeling on both sides of that coin, actually.
It's so, very annoying, actually, because when you're an account person in advertising and you're 10 minutes late for a meeting, everybody assumes it's because you're terribly busy. And as a creative who's actually reasonably punctual for meetings for the most part, okay, if you're 5 minutes late, everybody assumes it's because you're totally incompetent. It's an unbelievably unfair framing. In other words, the same behavior in a creative person gets attributed to something entirely different to that behavior when it's present in an account man.
So in this paper, was there any suggestion? I mean, I get very defensive about people who... what I call meeting bashers. People go, oh, we have too many meetings. We have too many, as if all meetings have the same value.
Yeah, no, no, no.
So,
yes,
of course, the coder example, that's very specific, right? I'm aware that you need to have a full run at a problem. And if you pull that person out of that problem in the middle, the whole thing inflates and evaporates. But that is a black and white example. But if you are a strategist, for example, you know, you can actually think about something for an hour or two and then get pulled off into a meeting about the Christmas party, and then actually your subconscious mind will in some way process what you've done in the previous 2 hours. So it's very easy to say, oh, meetings are terrible and we should have more time. But what was your...
Yeah, there's a lot of nonsense talked about all this. Of course, it's worth remembering that unlike emails, meetings are at least synchronous. So whereas a series of emails may make a more efficient use of individual time, the duration of problem solving is massively dilated and extended. Because, you know, if you imagine a conversation translated over email where you say something and then 24 hours later the person replies, this is a ludicrous way to try and solve problems collectively. The very asynchronicity of it is, you know, it makes every individual participant feel they're being efficient, whereas the process itself is being massively delayed. I also hate people when they say, yeah, but Zoom, it's not as good as a physical meeting. And you go, well, in some respects, from the second it starts to the second it ends, maybe it isn't quite as good. Although in some respects, it may be better, by the way. You know, for introverts and a variety of people, it may be better. It's less hierarchical. The fact that you feel less guilty about having a slightly random discursory chat may be an advantage. But most of the Zoom meetings we've had wouldn't have taken place as physical meetings anyway. So it's a nonsensical comparison. You know, we're failing to realize the opportunity cost of demanding that meetings are co-located. Because a one-hour meeting, even if it's only somewhere elsewhere in London, never mind Amsterdam or New York, a one-hour meeting effectively knocks out half your day.
This episode of the Shiny New Object podcast is brought to you in partnership with Madfest. Whether it's live in London or streamed online to the global marketing community, you can always expect a distinctive and daring blend of fast-paced content, startup innovation pitches, and unconventional entertainment from Madfest events. You'll find me causing trouble on stage, recording live versions of this podcast, and sharing a beer with the nicest and most influential people in marketing. Check it out at www.madfestlondon.com. So, Roy, you sort of stole your own thunder a little bit here, because we are at the halfway stage and we're going to move on to your shiny new object, which is the social norming of video calling. And you've already given us a bit of a view of how you're perceiving video. So can you give the audience a bit of an overview about why video calling is so exciting to you?
The supreme creative moment in English fiction, I think, is the Sherlock Holmes short story, The Silver Blaze, where Holmes refers to the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. And the curious incident, of course, is that the dog didn't do anything in the night. It didn't bark. Now, noticing things that nobody else notices, or even more creative still, noticing the absence of something that should be present, is a really interesting creative act. Okay. And I'm always, I think that ultimately creativity boils down to a mixture of curiosity and observation. It's very close to comedy in that respect, I think, that you notice things that other people don't, And one of the things that's worth commenting on, which has never really occurred to any of us, I think, and it only occurred to me a few weeks ago as a result of this Zoom revolution, is that once you've signed up for some form of white collar indoor employment, right, you have vastly less flexibility of your working pattern than, weirdly, people who go into blue collar work. So now I don't want to make this sound like, oh, the problems of the rich, because in many, many respects, white collar employment is disproportionately well remunerated, I would argue, and is also, a lot easier than, say, working on an oil rig. Okay. So I don't want us to make this sound like, a rich person's wine, but nevertheless, if you had caring responsibilities, parental responsibilities, if you needed your parents to look after your kids, if you wanted to work late at night, you wanted to work early in the morning, you wanted to work in a highly sociable environment, you wanted to work in a highly secluded environment, right? Lower paid blue collar jobs, I'm not going to say unskilled, because that's a nonsense. Okay, they can be highly skilled. You can choose from quite a wide range of forms of job, from waitressing to working in a supermarket to long distance lorry driver to taxi driver to, a plumber to builder, whatever it may be. Okay, if you like being outdoors, you can be outdoors. If you want to be indoors, you can be indoors. Once you sign up to basically white collar world, it's Monday to Friday, 5/7 of your daylight, 5 days a week in an office, in a specified, predetermined location, almost certainly in the middle of a city in which it's very expensive to live. Okay, there are exceptions to that. You could become a GP, you could become a teacher. But the number of jobs which are actually location independent are fairly few. And that seems to me an extraordinary opportunity for a new value exchange between employers and employees in office jobs. And it's worth remembering, of course, that once you've actually, when you think about it, we're almost forcing people into office jobs, because once you've got a student debt, okay, sunk cost bias almost requires you then to move to a very large city to get the kind of job which justifies the debt you've incurred through getting a 2-1 at the University of X. And so even if, to be honest, you would prefer to work in a completely different setting, you're almost obliged to enter the world of white-collar professional office employment. And I noticed this accidentally. My father gets his car repaired and serviced by a guy who lives locally, who's got a double first-class degree in classics from Oxford. And my father, when he got to know him better, did manage delicately to ask the question, you know, you've got a double first from Oxford, why are you repairing my car? And the answer was very simple. He said, I tried an office job, I couldn't stand it. Okay. Now, there must be a fairly large number of people who are in that position. There's also a much larger group of people who I think has moved to London out of necessity. And maybe when you're young, you quite like moving to a big city anyway. And they're now staying there because the job they do is now so specialized that it doesn't exist anywhere else. You know, I'm the vice chairman of an ad agency, right? There are about 9 cities on the planet where you can get sufficient employment being the vice chairman of an ad agency and founding a behavioral science practice. London, New York, obviously, probably Paris, Singapore, Hong Kong, maybe Shanghai, maybe Sydney. Okay. And well, probably Chicago. And then I'm starting to run out of places and I don't speak, you know, fluent French. So, you know, Frankfurt's kind of out of the question. And I don't speak German. And so Paris and Frankfurt are out of the question. Now, what we've always thought, okay, is first of all, we assumed that widespread, large scale video conferencing and remote working was impossible. I assumed, by the way, that the network might crack under the strain. Actually, it's not very heavy in bandwidth compared to movie downloads. The fact that Zoom, which is cloud-based, held up completely, pretty much, for the whole duration. But also the fact that actually this worked far, far better than anyone believed it might is a really important discovery which we shouldn't waste. Because in the medium to long term, it makes possible a new kind of value exchange between the employee and the employer. We always assumed that, okay, they had to come into the office, they had to live somewhere near London, which was bloody expensive. Even if their parents, who might have provided childcare, were living in North Norfolk, nope, you had to be close to London, okay? And you had to come in 5 days a week, okay? Now, I'm not suggesting you move to the Outer Hebrides. I'm not suggesting in all but a minority of cases, it'll be possible to come into the office never. But the change in the ratio is highly, highly economically significant. Okay. And it comes down to a simple thing. There are two kinds of networks. Okay. There are networks where it's kind of hub and spoke, and where your location on that network is absolutely decisive. Okay, and two examples of that would be rail networks, to an extent road networks, and air travel. Okay, it would be very, very difficult to be a global head on an international bit of business if you lived in, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico, right? Because every single long haul flight would require, you know, 1 or 2 changes of flight. Okay, and those are kind of networks that very large cities, mega cities. I'm not talking about small cities here. Small cities, Newcastle, Bristol, you know, Liverpool, very, very handsome cities, but they're small enough to enjoy you to allow you to work there without imposing high density urbanization on you. You know, if you live in Liverpool, you can kind of be as rural or as urban. If you work in Liverpool, you can kind of have a life that's as rural as or as a urban as you choose. You can live in high density, high rise accommodation. You can live in suburbia. You can live out in the countryside. The cities aren't so big as to actually make that impossible. But in mega cities, it's worth remembering they don't work that way at all. That actually, you know, once you have a double income household, and this makes it really complicated in London, okay? Even if you wanted to move out, it's 2 annual season tickets. And the likelihood that you both work in a place in London where one of you doesn't have a shit commute is actually quite low. You know, if one of you worked at DDB and the other one worked at BBDO, right? One of you is going to end up with a crap commute. If it was just DDB, you could move out of Paddington and go and live in Wiltshire. If it was just BBDO, you could come into London Bridge now, right? But it isn't anymore. Okay. And so the likelihood is that unless you and your partner are co-located at work, it's very difficult to move further out. I think this leads to a kind of thing called adaptive preference formation, by the way, where people pretend they like London because they've got no choice but to live there. It's like the fox and the grapes. You know, they start going, it's marvelously vibrant. You know, we've got a, we can buy a kumquat at 2 o'clock in the morning and there's a fantastic restaurant around the corner. Now, I don't want to be rude. You can find that level anywhere in the UK, okay? I live in Seven Oaks. I can buy a kumquat at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's because our local Tesco is open 24 hours a day, okay? There's a fantastic Indian restaurant. It delivers food, okay? What fascinated me is that under lockdown, I went into London on four occasions. On three occasions, on one occasion, I bought nothing. On three occasions, there was only one thing I wanted to buy that I couldn't find in Seven Oaks, in Tunbridge Wells, in Maidstone, okay? And that was, I went to Marouche and I bought a shawarma kebab, right? I don't know if you've ever been to Marouche on the Edgware Road. There are about five of them, but they're simply the best kebabs in the world. It's a Lebanese restaurant, okay? And the two things I can get in London that I can't get outside, okay. Theatre, I prefer watching it live broadcast to a cinema, okay? Food, it's not like 1986 where you can't get a latte in Sheffield, right? Okay, that general level of sophisticated food. There are a few exceptions. Korean food and Lebanese food are the two I miss if I don't go into London for a long period of time, okay? Now, it suddenly occurred to me that if when I go into London, the only thing I buy, which I can't buy at home, you know, if is a kebab, it doesn't say that much that the single biggest gain I get from having a city of 8 million people rather than the town of 30,000 is a kebab shop. And in fact, it would be cheaper for me to hire a full-time Lebanese chef than it would be to move back into London and try and maintain my quality of life that I enjoy outside the M25, right?
So
what I'm saying is that we've always looked at our employees and we said, there's work and there's free time and there's money. Those are the three things involved in the equation. More work, more money, less money, right? No. What I think we've discovered is that people value free where and free when, and to some degree free who, the freedom to work with people you like working with, but particularly free where and free when are more valuable than free time. So we've got the equation completely wrong. The way to reward staff is to allow them to work in places they choose. And that could be a cafe in London, by the way. It could be the office. But we've completely failed to understand this fundamental cost of being a location-dependent business, which is that not only is our office space expensive, but only a quarter of our money after tax, accommodation, and actually, probably, yes, a quarter of the salaries we pay to our staff make it into discretionary income. The rest, 75%, goes in transportation costs, it goes in accommodation costs, and it goes in tax, right? So we as Ogilvy have to earn about 130 quid, okay, to pay our staff 35. The way to improve that is not by giving them more money at a 25% efficiency rate. It's by allowing them to spend less on things they don't want to spend money on. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. It is very interesting, but I have the enviable job of trying to make this all tie into the future of marketing. So
right,
which
no,
is the promise
is
of the podcast.
Okay.
So it's an interesting point. I buy it mostly. So how does this affect a marketer? What could a brand
right.
do differently?
Well, any professional services business, any professional service business needs to be rethinking. This change, and the change was not so much brought about by technology, although much better video calling technology was essential to the change. It was brought about by the creation of a social norm. That saying, let's meet over video, used to be Dr. Pepper Zero, and it's now Coca-Cola. It's a perfectly normal thing to request, okay? And that normalization, very similar, by the way, you won't remember this, but the fax machine and the widespread adoption of the fax machine was invented in the 19th century, right? The widespread adoption of the fax machine happened in the 1980s because of a postal strike. Because new norms are created when you have a big simultaneous disruption to behavior. Okay. Now, what we need to be doing, this is an order of magnitude more important as a technological and behavioral change than nearly everybody is giving it credit for. I think, and I'm doing a bit of this myself, Ogilvy should be having and every large professional services business should be holding a kind of a think tank around how we reinvent our business on the back of this technology. And that, by the way, applies to our client businesses as well. I had some people do a live, very high-tech demonstration of the Quokka over video to me and my daughter at home yesterday afternoon. Okay, they were in Manchester in a showroom which was kitted out with about 5 cameras. They gave me the sales spiel, right? Okay. And the fascinating thing that emerged from it is, A, they sold me one of those Quokkas. B, what they told me is that they were so amazed with the success of the online sales of this device. Now, admittedly, people are at home more, so getting things installed is a bit easier than it is when people are in the office 5 days a week. Okay, but the interesting thing was they actually sold out of Quokkas for the first 3 months of lockdown. That's that boiling water device, which gives you instant boiling water on tap. Okay, it was more effective than having a physical showroom by some massive degree. Now, that's really, really important. Okay, we need to know more about this. Okay. But the really important thing is, if you're a professional services firm where you effectively, you know, it's all about information exchange. The reason big cities existed was because the serendipitous encounters scale exponentially with size. Okay. But if Zoom is better than very big cities for serendipitous encounters, which it is, because the opportunity cost of an hour of Zoom call is much, much less than the opportunity cost of a physical meeting, right? Then essentially it supplants the need for cities. The last remaining need for cities, apart from Tinder. I get the fact that if you're 25, Tinder in London's a lot better than Tinder in Cornwall. I get that, right? I get the fact that if you're 25, you want to go to really crowded spaces and take drugs and go woo, and then send other people photographs of your genitals, which is what young people do nowadays. We wouldn't have done that. Apart from else, it would have meant a very awkward wait in the queue at Boots, right? But nonetheless, okay, I get the fact that young people need to be in London. Essential workers need to be in London. If the people who don't want to be there and don't need to be there can move out to some degree, this is potentially, okay, it's an end to the pensions crisis. I think most people retire because they want to stop commuting, not because they want to stop work, okay? It's potentially a solution to the housing crisis, okay? It's a solution arguably to leveling up the economy because it removes this winner takes all concentration of wealth, not all of which is productive either, some of it's extractive, in very, very narrow centres of geographical location, specifically the southeast. Okay, this is a much, much bigger thing potentially than we think. Now, in the professional services and marketing services agency, I'll give you an example, okay? First of all, we can become a bit more random. We should be starting to, we can now offer services to a far wider audience of clients and customers, okay? Because when you don't actually, first of all, globally, because is it worth me? I told all my staff once this happened, I said, become more random. Speak on podcasts, which aren't strictly speaking, you know, relevant to your job. Have conversations with people you wouldn't normally talk to. Attend an online webinar in a subject that is only tangentially related to the work you do. And the question is, why? Why should I become more random? Surely under a crisis, I should become more focused. No. Because the gains to randomness, the barriers to gains from randomness have gone down. Let me explain, okay? Let's say there's a guy in California who has a marketing problem, okay? Now, in the old world, maybe there was a 5% chance of £100,000 worth of business. In the old world, was it worth flying out to California, staying in a hotel, giving up 2 days of my week in order to explore that possibility? No, it was not, right? Okay, is it worth an hour of my time on Zoom to explore that possibility? Well, unless my time is valued at more than $5,000 an hour, the answer is yes. So we can afford to be much more probabilistic about the kind of encounters we have. And that really, really matters. And one of my theories is that practically everybody on the planet, other than Barack Obama, okay, and, you know, David Beckham. Practically everybody on the planet will give you an hour of their time on Zoom for $1,000 or less. Right? Because when there's no commitment of place, and when there's no travel cost, and when there's, you know, when essentially also you can reschedule the talk very easily, okay? The pain is massively reduced because, it is literally just an hour of my time. I can be on holiday, come in from the beach, put on a shirt, deliver an hour of your time, go back to beach, right? Okay? It's not like committing to being in Amsterdam for an hour. And we have to understand that the way that not only the way we work with clients and who needs to change, who those clients are can change. Okay. I've always liked that Keynes phrase that he always envisaged that economics should become a bit like dentistry. You know, you should have a local economist. And if you had a bit of an economic problem, you'd pop into your local economist surgery and he'd help you out. And in the same way, I'd like marketing to become a bit more like dentistry. I think there are, for every problem which is on the desk of a marketing director of a global multinational packaged goods company, there are 1,000 problems out there which creative marketers can solve, which they haven't been given the opportunity to solve. And I think that video calling and the widespread normalization of it gives us the opportunity to create completely new lines of business.
And Rory, I'm afraid that
we've hit time, but it's a pretty good sentence on which to end.
What a lovely place to finish it. Yes, I was waiting for that. So if someone wants to get in touch with you, Rory, how would you like them to do that?
Twitter, at Rory Sutherland, is always good. Alternatively, LinkedIn is always good, but Twitter is probably the best first port of call.
Fantastic. Rory, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a joy. Thank you very much indeed.
Hi, just before you go, I'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to write a review of the Shiny New Object podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever it's called these days, or whichever podcast provider you use. We're an indie podcast, so it would go a long way for us if you could just share the word and give us a bit of a support on those channels. That'd just be fantastic. If you haven't got time, that's also cool. And yeah, if you could tell your colleagues about the podcast, and also, if possible, don't forget to subscribe. And I'd love to hear your feedback. If you'd like to speak on the podcast or be a guest, or you think I'm asking the wrong questions, anything, I'd be super interested to hear what you think. So please email me at tom@automatedcreative.net. That's T-O-M at, I'm not going to bother spelling it. Anyway, you'll work it out. Thanks so much.